power
Okay.
wisely.
I got.
Need to be wise.
Okay, got it. Your name shows as Jay's name.
Okay, so John, you want to hear the compliment?
Yes, please.
Somebody said, I must admit, I'm digging the Silver Fox hippie look he's sporting these days.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm old. Yeah, I'm going back to this way. I looked at Woodstock. Let's just say that. This is Woodstock all over again.
Silver Fox hippie. It's a vibe.
I wasn't a Silver Fox at Woodstock. No.
Let me put that on your bio.
Oh yeah, I'm like talking it out. Okay, so we're live. Okay, let me share. Yeah, actually, I would love some headphones because otherwise, I'll hear them here. It'll distract me.
Are you gonna, Jen? Are you gonna ask a lot of questions, or are you gonna let me just go off on a tangent? You're gonna jump in and out.
So
how do you want to do this?
I'm gonna tee you off. You start telling the story. I'll ask questions when I need stuff filled in.
Okay. Okay.
I know a lot about this case, though. So.
Okay. Did you read the books?
I haven't read any of the books, but I've read a lot of articles. I've listened to a couple of different podcasts. And the first thing, I don't even want to, like, oh, man, I wanted to jump in. But my first thing I need to talk about when we do get to it, the people at the Apple store.
It's going to be in the presentation.
Okay, I'll shut up.
It's a video. I have a video of them going to the wall.
To the wall.
Listening to the murder and not calling anybody. It's in the presentation.
Kitty Genovese all over again, right?
Yeah. That's you're too young to know Kitty Genovese, but that you are
Who
absolutely
are you?
That's it. I actually had somebody use that against me in a trial one time. A really smart lawyer out of New York. He cited Kitty Genovese, who was murdered outside of that apartment building. Yep, and everybody listened to her being killed, and no one helped her.
You can't use that. I could get into that too. You can't use that actually in a trial these days any longer because it's pretty much been debunked when you start to look at the breakdown of it. But man, I could talk about this stuff for hours. So let's like kick off though, because people are listening right now. So
okay,
hi guys, welcome to Six Cool Stories. As always, I'm your host Jenna Levine Liu, the founder of Six Cool Moms. And today, I'm just gonna jump right in because I'm so excited. I'm like ready to go. So today we have a very exciting guest. It's John McCarthy. He's the state's attorney for Montgomery County, Maryland, and he's going to be talking about his history. Or it's not even history. You were the lead prosecutor in the Lululemon murder case, which is, for those Montgomery County residents, you definitely have heard of this. And, you know, the country as a whole has heard of this case. And it's known as the Lululemon murders. That's its moniker.
Yes.
But it's one of the most interesting true crime cases. And I am a true crime aficionado, I'd like to say. It's one of the crazier cases that I have heard. And when you start to hear the details that come out, how this all happened and how it came to be in the trial itself, it's just very, very fascinating. So, John, I don't want to take too much time. I don't really have any housekeeping to get to except the blow-up and show-up parade tomorrow, the Rio Gaithersburg, wear your costumes, coming out, support the Salvation Army. But other than that, John, yeah, tell us a little bit about, I mean, I know who you are, but tell us a little bit about who you are and your experience working with the Lululemon case, and I know you have some slides and a presentation so those that are watching live, enjoy.
Well, Jen, first of all, thank you for asking me to be here with you. I have been a member of this office for many decades. I've been the state's attorney for Montgomery County for 16 years and running for re-election again as state's attorney. During the time as state's attorney, I guess, besides helping to run an office where I have 90 lawyers, 70% of my lawyers, by the way, are in fact women. I have seven teams of lawyers.
Love it.
Five of my teams are headed by women. I've got two deputies, and one of my deputies is a woman. So I will tell you, the majority of my staff being women and the decision makers and helping guide this office, I hope that the listening audience recognizes that we understand the pivotal role that women play in all aspects of criminal justice, and they are vital to how my office operates. But I became involved in the Lululemon murder case actually the day it occurred. This murder goes back to March 11, 2011, Bethesda. I was actually out having breakfast at a diner in Montgomery County when I got a call from the Washington Post. And the Washington Post reporter said to me, "What's going on at the Lululemon store in Bethesda?" I traveled down there and I was there within hours.
It was around 8:30 that the store manager finally called the police, right?
Yes. This is, I'm trying to think, this thing's not advancing.
Gotta love technology, man.
Yeah, the screens are not, they're not, usually just clicking, shifting. You know?
Can we do the audio version of it? Well, we'll cut out any.
Yeah. In any instance, I went down there. I was there very early in the morning. You know, for anybody who doesn't know it, Lululemon store is actually in Bethesda, but it's on Bethesda Avenue. It's a very, you know, trendy, safe area. Crimes, homicides are virtually or almost entirely unheard of in this particular area of the county. And so I got down there and the entire community was very much very much engaged in this. But how did the case get discovered?
So that's
about 8:30 in the morning when a young girl whose name's Rachel, who is the office manager, the store manager, who lived directly across the street from Lululemon, came over to go into the store. The door was ajar, the lights were on, things were strewn all over the place. Steps outside, there's a young guy who is waiting for the Apple store, which is directly next door, to open. But she is scared by the fact that door is open, the lights are still on, and things are thrown all over the place. She asks this young man to go inside, check the store. He walks inside and he discovers this young woman that you see in this picture appears to be unconscious on the floor. Her clothes are tattered and torn. She appears to be unconscious. Her hands are bound hand and foot. There is a significant amount of blood underneath of her on the floor. There appeared to be some type of a razor cuts to her belly. It appears to be some kind of an injury to her head, as you can see. These pictures were actually taken by the immediate first responding officer who got to the scene. This was the first victim was found. This is her version of what happened.
From her. And I couldn't do anything. And all I could think was it was my fault because I forgot my wallet and I couldn't help her. And I was like seeing this. Both of them had like masks.
What kind of masks?
And you could barely even see their eyes.
Was it like two holes?
Yeah.
Or was it one?
It was two.
Two holes?
But they were laughing though, they thought it was funny. They were laughing the entire time.
Okay. How about their race? Could you tell?
I have no idea.
How about gloves?
Yeah, when he grabbed me by my neck and he did have something on his hands.
Okay.
May I say that this particular recording is of the young woman that you saw just a moment ago who was found alive in the Lululemon, bound hand and foot. There was another young woman, her name is Jana Murray, a brilliant young woman, 30 years old, who was on the eve of receiving her third master's degree that was going to be from Johns Hopkins University. She had taken a job at the Lululemon store to work on her thesis for her master's. One of her professors became enamored by the kind of the philosophy of Lululemon and thought that as a business major working on her MBA, she would enjoy meeting the other young women that worked there when it was pretty much exclusively a store that employed up-and-coming young women, and that was their corporate model, and that was what she wrote her paper about. But when she got there, she kind of fell in love with the other young women that she worked with. She liked to stay there. And so despite the fact that she'd gotten done writing her thesis, she stayed there. The evening before, these women were...
I'm sorry, not to just to, wasn't she planning on leaving shortly thereafter to become an instructor at Equinox?
Yes, the woman that you see here was working at the Lululemon store. She had recently transferred to the Bethesda store from the Georgetown store, but she was about to leave. This woman's name is Brittany Norwood. She was about to leave the Lululemon to take a job as a trainer at the Equinox store. As a young girl, excuse me?
So Brittany was not Janet.
Not Jana. Jana was engaged to get married, and she was going to go move to Seattle. And at some point in time, you're going to see a picture of Jana in this presentation, and you're going to see a picture of her with her fiance. Now, the version that we got, the police have one dead young woman and one live young woman. The person who is alive is the person whose voice you just heard. The person that is alive is the person that you saw in those first pictures, bound hand and foot, unconscious on the floor, with apparently some physical injuries. She described and said, the night before I left the store about 9 o'clock, when I left, I forgot my Metro pass. So I called Jana, who was the store manager, and said, hey, can you let me back into the store to get my bus pass? When they came back to the store, she claimed two men, one shorter, one taller, all dressed in black, followed them back into the store. This is actually a photograph that we took, that Apple Store had with a camera that was immediately behind their stores. And the Apple Store and the Lululemon Store literally abutted one another. We see two men dressed all in black, one shorter, one taller. We thought, on the initial day of the investigation, oh my God, here is an actual picture of the people who committed this sexual assault on this one young lady, injured her, and murdered this other young lady. I'm going to jump ahead and tell you, these men, we found them. They were dishwashers. They worked in an adjacent, I think it's called Uncle Julio's, a Tex-Mex bar on the corner, had nothing to do with the case whatsoever, but there is the coincidence of this happening. For those of you who don't know Bethesda, I'm now showing you an aerial map. You can see the Apple Store sort of over on the left-hand side there. It's labeled. It's a small little box that's in yellow. The Lululemon store is in red. It's immediately next door. Off to the right, you're going to see a parking lot that is approximately a third of a mile away. That's going to be important as the story develops, because Jana Murray's car with blood in it is going to be discovered in that parking lot the next day after the murder takes place.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So you said you were on site by 9:30.
Mm-hmm.
So when you went in the store from your, I mean, at this point you had what, 30 years of experience?
Right.
Something like that. When you went in that store, was your gut instinct, something doesn't feel right?
Let me say to you, I have had a lot of experience doing homicides. I believed completely the version that was given by the young woman. I saw the pictures. I listened to the interviews, and I saw what had happened to Jana Murray. You're looking at a picture of the outside of the Lululemon store as it looked then. It's still there, but it's been totally remodeled. It does not look like the same thing. There's some officers in the scene. You see those glass windows directly behind those officers. That's the Apple Store. But again, I will tell you, I did not suspect on Saturday. It was a Saturday morning when they were discovered. I didn't suspect it Sunday. By Monday, things began to fall apart for a variety of reasons.
So Here's from my perspective, and again, I lived here at this time, so it was 2011. So I was in my mid-20s, and I was working a retail job around that time. And I remember when it first happened, and people were scared of there being guys and, you know, in the area that are going around
right.
doing this. But when I take sort of a step away 10 years later, when I, you know, look at the details, and it's very easy to go back and look at the details and be like, but I, from my perspective, that, unless it was, you know, a random crime, because, you know, you'll get into the details later,
right.
tools and stuff that they used, why would that be the location in which they would pick to do an attack like that? Because it's not a very good one in terms of visibility or cameras being present right next to an Apple store. The iPad 2 had dropped that day. There's just a couple of things that if I, you know, was going to, you know, attack and sexually assault women and rob them, I don't necessarily know of Bethesda Row, but then again, it's easy for me to look in hindsight and be 10 years later and say that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, I, let me just say that in hindsight and rapidly over the 48 to 72 hours after the discovery of Jaina's murder and the initial interview of Brittany, where she tells us about these two men that attacked them, we took it. Well, we look, you saw the condition of what she looked like when you first get there. She certainly looked like a victim. She certainly sounded like a victim. She told us a story about two men dressed in black. We found a picture that fit into the time frame. It showed two men, one taller, one smaller. It sounded like a pretty viable story. I mean, I will tell you, on that particular evening, I think it was terrifying to think that two men would do what happened to these young women. But I believe I am telling you, I did believe it. I believed her initial story, and I thought it was corroborated by her initially her physical injuries as they appeared to me in those initial things. Look, ultimately, there's going to be a lot of forensics involved in this case. This is the most forensically intense case ever investigated in Montgomery County. This is a floor plan of the interior of the Lululemon store, the entrance on Bethesda Avenue is to the far left. There actually is a rear door that goes out to the rear parking lot. That rear parking lot is where the two men all dressed in black were photographed. There's a women and men's dressing room at this establishment. The women's dressing room that you see in this diagram is where she was found. Now, this is another picture. And this is a picture. And again, we blurred out some portions of this, but there's a lot of things in this picture. This actually is the body of Jaina Murray. There's, as you can see, there are massive amounts of blood here, and
footprints.
We look at this picture, and you begin to read the crime scene, and you begin to learn a little bit about how the death occurred. And there's a lot in these pictures that tell you what happened. By the way, on the right hand side, I hope you can see that there is a door handle there that leads back in. This is a narrow hallway that leads to the back door where they took deliveries for the store. This is not the public entrance. This is the rear of the store.
Oh, so she's literally, that door to the right is literally the door right to the outside.
That's the door back into the store.
Oh, okay.
If you followed this diagram back further about another 20 feet, you go out the back door into a rear parking lot.
Gotcha.
But you also see here, with Jaina's body being as close as it was to the door, it was literally hard initially to open. You can only open the door 7 or 8 inches before the door would hit her body. This is where she
through the door too.
Yes. And if, as you look at this picture, The store itself would be to the right. The back door would be behind you.
Okay.
And to the left, there are some storage shelves, but on the other side of the storage shelves is the Apple store.
Right,
what we're going to talk about.
It's right there.
Now, if you look at this picture, this is sort of reading of the crime scene here. There's a number of things here. Blood spatter experts. A guy named Bill Vosburgh, I think the most brilliant blood spatter guy in the United States of America, is who I retained to testify in this case. He literally could tell a story based on the blood spatter. And you can see there's an enormous amount of blood here. In this picture, there is actually rope around the neck of Jaina on the floor. There are a number of weapons. I think there were 8 to 10 different weapons used in this attack. You also can see a red toolbox that's off to the left on top of the body. If you read the crime scene, you're going to realize the red toolbox is a late arrival. What do I mean? That box fell onto the body after the murder. Why? Because when you look at it, there's really no blood on it. And if it had been there in that location initially, that was something that happened after the event. Now, I believe that, and Jenna, I've already said this, I believed her story 100%. But then three things happened.
She told a great story. She was emotional.
Told a great story.
Covered in blood. Yeah, it's definitely upon first hearing it. And again, these kind of cases, I mean, if you listen to true crime podcasts, you read books, you think it happens all the time. It does not happen all the time, and definitely not like this. So yeah, even a seasoned professional, and I, what I've heard or read about this particular case is that it was so brutal and so violent that most people investigating or, you know, first responders were like, absolutely horrified by what they had seen, and you almost don't even have time to create a reaction because you're processing the fact that there's this 30-year-old woman who had over 300, you know, brutal injuries.
But you know, about three days into the story, she is very much being treated as a victim. Brittany is staying with her sister at her home in the District of Columbia. But we begin to find out the following things. Number one, there was an allegation that Brittany had been accused of shoplifting the night of the store. They had a bag policy. If I work with you, Jenna, you check my bag before we walk out. You check mine. On that particular evening, Jaina found that Brittany had stolen a pair of pants. She alerted after they separated. She alerted the store manager that there had been a theft. Brittany knew things were going to come down on her the next day, and she knew that she was going to be reported for shoplifting. Now, is that why she had the ruse of luring Jaina back to the store to say, hey, look, I'm leaving. I'm going to go work at Equinox. Don't rat me out. Don't tell anybody. I'll quit tomorrow. Just let's forget about it. But the reality is by the time they got back to the store, Jaina had already called the store manager. There's also inconsistencies. Brittany did speak to the police on 6 or 7 different occasions, and every single time the stories were different. And we also got information from the Apple employees. And I'm going to play for you the Apple video now. Now, you're going to see some movement here in a second. There are two figures in this video. And the two figures in the video are the manager and the assistant manager of the Apple store, which is directly next door. The smaller figure is a female assistant manager. The taller guy is she heard noises when they were closing shop. This is, you know, it's about 10:15, 22:15. It's about 10:15 in the evening. They are now back over by they're literally walked to the wall. And on the other side of the wall would be where the murder occurs if you put these buildings next to each other. They are sitting there and they are listening to two women fighting. And some of the words are made out like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing it? Tell me what this is all about. And they heard screaming, they heard yelling between two women. They did not call anybody.
Didn't they hear the victim, you know, at this point, they're both victims, but didn't they hear Janelle say something like, you don't have to do this?
That's yes. There were a number of things said back and forth. And you have to remember, Jeanette, Brittany's story is two men followed them in and attacked them. Their version is it was two women talking to each other, having a verbal fight, no male voices at all. Inconsistency with the report. We now find out there's a theft allegation. Now the fight is between two women. There is no men involved in it. Inconsistencies in the story. Now, forensically, and again, this we looked at blood spatter, finger palm impressions, DNA profiling, track and trail, luminol spray, forensic odontology, sexual assault nurses were brought in, pathologists were brought in. This was one expert after another to begin to put this case together. There's a lot about blood spatter terminology. I'm going to skip through that. But here's a picture about this officer is 6 foot two. He's standing in precisely and exactly the spot where I showed you earlier Jana's body was found. He is holding a tape measure from the floor up to show that the first blood spatter against the wall in that area was at about a 6 foot level.
That's then, bigger. Like, but you have to get some height or some, you know, some swing behind you to get that high, right?
Yeah, and this is the door level. So you come down to about a 4 foot level and you can see a little bit more blood. And by the way, there's a difference between cast off and spray, and all that gets explained by the expert. And this is down by the floor level. Obviously, tremendously more blood at the floor level. What does the blood spatter expert tell us? Well, what this means is when the attack started, they were facing each other and standing. At some point in time, the victim went to their knees. That's why, and stayed knee down on the knees for some period of time. That's why you have more blood at the intermediate level. And finally, what this crime scene tells us is the vast majority of the blood and the cast off is all the way down at the floor level, which tells you that the victim during the majority of the blows was actually already down.
So the first hit was her standing up. And then as the attack progressed, she obviously, as she was getting weaker, kneeled down. And then the attack finished, she was at that point probably lying face down on the floor and was already.
Yeah, and I will tell you, there's some other pictures we have here. I will tell you, I think the attack did not start where she died. I think
okay, that's what I thought. I thought that because, but again, I didn't see the rest of the
story. It started. It really
like
went
backed in a corner.
I think that she tried to escape. I think that Janet made a run for the back door, which had a push door handle on it. She wouldn't even need a key. She could have pushed her way out, but she had already been hit in the head with a very heavy object, which I'm going to show you in a couple of minutes. But these are bookcases. Remember I told you that where her body was, there were bookcases to the left-hand side? Mm-hmm. Blood spatter expert says, hey, John, let's take these things out into the hallway, lay them over. This is the underneath of the bookcases. These are the bottom shelves of the bookcases.
So that's what that means, back?
That means that the body must be lower than the bottom of these shelves. So again, reading the crime scene, telling you how the murder occurred, you know that the victim is below this because the blood's coming up to the bottom of the bookcases. This tells you the relative position, at least during a large part of the attack. And these are just close-up pictures. This is cast off. This is cast off from weapons. Again, hammers, knives, box cutters, ropes, a lot of things were used in this attack. And you hit something that has blood on it, you draw it back, and you cast off blood in the closest area.
Okay.
And this is
follow-up questions. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have a lot of questions. Okay, so I know that there were several weapons. It was between 5 and 10 that they determined were used on her. So during this attack where she's standing and then going down, is it one weapon? And then once she's down, she switches it out? Or is she literally just picking things up and just going, you know, nuts?
I think that the primary weapon that she killed her with is what you're now looking at right there. That is actually what they call a merchandise peg, merch peg. You can see blood on it. That is blood deposited by the attack. From the DNA testing, we know ultimately all of that blood belongs to Jana Murray. There literally are, she's hit so severely that we could actually see, sometimes when weapons or tools are used, they leave marks. And you can actually look at an object or even a person and see where, this is where that object hit them. I'm not showing you these images. Look. This is really the sanitized version of this, believe it or not. This There are places where I could show you where she was hit with that object. And it
but
was
if you want to respect the victim and her, you know.
Yeah, sure. So but this is the primary murder weapon. That's the first weapon she was hit with. And that weapon is used throughout, but others are used as well. Now this is going to be important later on too, because remember she says there's two men that are attacking them in the store. We are going to do track and trail because there's a lot of bloody footprints all over the store. These are the bottom of Jaina's shoes. And there is blood here that drips on those shoes. The blood spatter expert says, look, that's not the result of any injury. It's the person who is assaulting her, was probably down on top of her, stands up and drips blood onto her shoes. What these shoes also tell you is that Jaina Murray never walked in the blood. If there are two shoe impressions all over the store, one of them is not Jaina. There are two people we got to look for, but it's not Jaina. This is also, again, this is on the floor where Brittany is found. The blood spatter guy looks at this and there's a problem here. This is not just blood. It looked like blood. And at first blush, people think it is blood, but there's a lot of water there. There's two things the blood spatter expert tells us about this. Number one, this is diluted blood that somebody tries to make look like more blood. And there's also a swipe. A swipe is where someone takes an object, maybe an article of clothing, and runs it through the blood to smear it around. This is not a natural flow of blood. This is somebody who is trying to dilute the blood, make it look like a larger pool. And this was directly underneath of Brittany. Now there's also a problem. As I say, even in Bethesda, gravity works. This is a woman who claims that she was unconscious on the floor for hours, with her hands tied up over her head. Where would the blood flow if that was really the position she was in? It would have flowed backward into her hair. She had no blood in her hair. The blood flowed this way. The blood can't flow this way. You saw the position earlier. That presentation is inconsistent with how she was found. And the way the blood flowed was inconsistent with the story she told.
Weren't most of her wounds, like once you got into it, totally superficial? So it looked like
very extremely. There was
one cut that was like bad, maybe here. Was that it?
She had her injuries, once you actually cleaned her up, were almost non-existent.
Yeah.
I will tell you this. This is the men's room. I showed you the diagram earlier. The only thing I'm going to tell you is that. See, there's a picture on the left-hand side of this, and it looks like light switches, two little white light switches, and there's a red smudge right to the left of those two white boxes. It was the left palm of Jaina Murray.
So she was trying.
I believe the attack occurred in a different area. I think she was hit in the back of the head, massive injuries to the back of her head. I think she did what any... Someone begins to hit you in the back of the head with something. It was the merch peg. You take your hands and you protect your head. She is attempting to run for the front door. She stumbles. This is her palm impression in her own blood here. She was chased from the back of the store, tried to go out the front door, couldn't get out that way, then made a dash for the back door. That's why she died in that narrow hallway going to the back part of the store.
Do you think that if she had stayed in the front of the store and just started banging on the windows, it maybe wouldn't have happened that way?
You know, look, anybody who knows Bethesda, this is it's an area that I go out to dinner at. There were restaurants there. The Apple store next door was just closing up around the time that this whole thing started. Is it possible someone might have heard it? This was a vicious attack. This woman was running for her life, and I think she made the decision. The only way she could save herself was to get out of there. This is actually a picture, and it's a pretty gruesome picture, but this is a picture of Jaina's hand at the autopsy. Those are clumps of her own hair. So she took her hands began to try to protect herself and took away in her own hand the hair that was being chopped off of her of her when she was being attacked. This is a brutal attack. This is Jana Murray. This is obviously this is on an autopsy table, and there are a couple of things that that's her nose at the top of this picture, but there are ligature marks across her chin. There was a rope among the weapons that were used to kill her. Was a rope.
So now, was she trying to just choke her, and it just went up and just cut her?
I think that Jana was probably the fibers from the rope were on Jana's hand at the autopsy too. I think she tried to put the rope around her and was going to strangle her on top of all the cutting injuries. When she tried to do that, Jana was a strong young woman.
Yeah.
She tried to not allow her to do that. And so the fibers from the rope got onto her hands. And if you look at her chin, between her mouth and her chin, there is more blood that rises to the surface at that point in time. What that tells you is she's still alive. Her heart is still beating. As your heart beats, the blood circulates, and during an assault like this, the blood will rise to the surface as long as your heart's beating. When you actually see the rope burns around her neck, you see less blood rising to the surface. Why? Her heart is beating more slowly, and she's in the process of beginning to die.
So from what I read too, that she fought like the entire throughout all 300 and something wounds that she was getting.
One of the saddest things, she came from a great family. I met her mom, dad, sister-in-law, brother, fabulous people. She was a wonderful woman. And at the end of this, I'm going to show you a video of her. I'm going to show you on her 30th. I'm showing these terrible pictures. I always end this program by showing a video of her on her 30th birthday with her fiance. So you're going to see an in-life picture of this wonderful, wonderful woman at the end of this presentation, because this is such a horrific thing. And sometimes you get lost thinking about who was this person who lost their life. You're going to meet her at the end of this presentation, I promise. You'll see her.
That's sometimes the hard thing about these cases too, because they are fascinating in a way, and it does feed into our interest of true crime. But it is important to remember that this was a real person. Again, she was young. She was 30 years old. She was smart. She was beautiful. She had a lot to offer this world, and she definitely should not have lost her life for calling out a coworker on, shoplifting, if that was the case. Nobody deserves to die in the way that she did. But the good thing, not good, there's nothing good. The thing is that when people do get attacked, when they do fight back, the evidence that gets left does a lot of the times help solve these cases. So the way she fought, and from what I read, and again, you know this more than just, me reading articles, is that the defensive wounds that she had on her hands and her body were more than the medical examiner had ever
seen. Yeah, the number of wounds in this case exceeded the greatest number of wounds that had ever been seen by the medical examiner's office in Maryland.
And she was alive until there was one final...
Based on the forensic findings, every wound had a blood path. You don't have a blood path if the heart stops beating and you're dead. Because there was every wound had a blood path, the medical examiner was asked, how many of these injuries did she live through? And it was every injury absent the very last one, which was a knife wound to the back of her head.
And that it severed her spine, right?
It severed her brain stem.
Her brain stem, yeah.
Right. Again, going back to the rope that you see in the bag on the bottom is the rope that was taken at the autopsy and bagged by the autopsy people. You see the rope in the top left hand, that's the rope around her neck. You see the results of the attempted ligature on the pictures of her at the autopsy. There was more rope of the same type on the bookcase immediately to the left of her that was found there. We did DNA on the ends of the rope. We did DNA testing on the ends of the rope, that was around her neck, as well as the rope that was left on the shelf. It was Brittany's DNA. She also staged, what she also did, and this is up by the register area in the front of the store, to make it look like she actually had been followed into the store, she staged and made it look like there was a robbery of the store. Now, this murder probably took place approximately between 10 and 10:15 in the evening. The body is not...
What time did the store close?
It closes at 9. The girl, both women left. They both went back because she said she forgot her pass. They get back to the store about 9:30. And I don't know what, and the overheard argument is about 10:15 by the people next door, but she stages a robbery. And she actually does steal money from the store that's never recovered, about $600. But
where'd
she
go?
I think she threw it into the trash can out in front of the store.
It wasn't about the money at the end of the
It was never about the money. It was about creating an image. Now, remember I said to you that there were two in the area of the store. There were two distinct. This was probably the biggest aha moment of the entire case. I'm going to say this is late Monday afternoon. The murder occurs Friday night. It's discovered on Saturday. Brittany is interviewed on Saturday and Sunday. Monday afternoon, a wonderful detective by the name of Craig Wittenberger sees these shoes there. Lululemon is a fancy schmancy place. Maybe some of your listeners buy their clothes there. And they actually fit clothing. And in order to fit the clothing on you, they have dressing rooms. And they have shoes that either women or men can slip into, try on the attire. They, you know, just like you're going to get, it's going to be tailored. So it looks fabulous when you go to the gym or you go to do yoga. The bottom pair of shoes here is a men's pair of shoes. The detectives all of a sudden notice on Monday, these shoes just laying there and they're all cleaned up. There's no blood on them, but that's the men's size, like 16 or 15 shoe. Those are the bloody shoe impressions that are all over the store. Look, I think anybody looking at this picture, you realize that that shoe made that impression. What that means is Brittany put on the men's shoes, went over to where Jana was, stomped around in the blood, and then walked all over the store with her blood, took the shoes off, washed them off, and put them back onto the shelf. She needed two pair of footprints because there were two men.
So who noticed that? Like, who saw the second pair of shoes and was
a guy named Craig Wittenberger, a wonderful detective now retired from Montgomery County Homicide. Craig Wittenberger saw the shoes and says, "What are these shoes?" Looked at them, and we were doing track and trail. We were trying to look at. You can look. Everybody's seen enough of these forensic file cases to know that sometimes, you know, there's tire impressions, there's shoe impressions, there's fingerprints. He was looking and he saw the shoes and he goes, "What's with these shoes?" Now they were perfectly clean when he found them. She had from 10 o'clock at night till 9 o'clock in the morning. She had 11 hours to make this scene look like whatever she wanted to make it look like. Here's a perfect example of having to learn how to read a crime scene. Those ugly orange chairs is where everybody who worked in the store kept their purses, pocketbooks, and stuff like that. This is exactly where the girls would have gone if you said to me, I forgot my purse, I forgot my wallet, I got to go back. This is where it would be. It's in a storage area in the back. See all the footprints there, the crazy footprints there? Looks like there's a huge struggle and lots of blood. Here's a problem. The ladder's there, there's a chair there, there's a mop there. It's blood all over the floor. You know what, where there's not blood?
Under the
top of the ladder, on top of the chair, on top of the mop. She doctored the crime scene to make it look like there'd been a struggle there, but she didn't put any blood on top of the items. She just laid them neatly into the crime scene to make it look like there'd been a fight back here. She had, she had 11 hours to do this. This is another, you know, if you look at the impressions, and these are with those shoes that I was just telling you about, these were none of these. It's like some of the cops described it. It was like the chicken dance. It was like there was nothing natural about the movements. It was like literally somebody just trying to create a very irregular pattern of blood all over the store. And that's what we had to follow. This is a second pair of shoes, impressions who were found in the blood. That shoe is Brittany's shoe. As a matter of fact, if you can even look on the picture on the right, you can see those shoelaces. Jenna, maybe you have some of these where they're gathered, they're not gathered. A lot, you know. And then you see at this is Brittany's shoe to the left, and this is Brittany's shoe on the right, her socks and things like that. Bottom line is inside of her shoe, it's all Janet's blood. What's wrong with that? Well, if you go back to the story you heard in the very beginning, and she's talking about how they were followed back in. I couldn't get to her. I couldn't help her. There's no explanation for why Janet's blood would be on Brittany's shoes, because her story was the two men separated them. One man attacked Jana, and in a different area of the store, she was attacked by another man. But she has her. Yes.
Sure. So for you as the prosecutor, how does it, so your involvement in this, how does it come to a place where who decides, you know, from the state, we're going to bring charges against this person. These are the charges they're going to be. Here's why they're
going to. The state's attorney's office does.
So they
do the investigation. We were in consult, literally probably worked pretty much around the clock for about a week with them and with the police. You know, we have some input, like, for instance, the hiring of the blood spatter expert, Bill Vosburg, who may have been the single most important witness in the case, other than Brittany Norwood, ultimately, because of so many different stories she told, really convicted herself. We made the call on Friday, 1 week to the day after the thing was discovered. And I looked at, and I will say to you, I'm giving you all the forensic results right now. When we made the call to arrest her, we didn't have the DNA yet. We didn't have the track and trail yet. Bill Vosburg hadn't done his, you know, blood spatter analysis.
It was there. You knew that it was going to be.
Well, again, we did. The case got better as time went on, as the forensic evidence began to mount. I'll also give you an example. We talked about the shoes that are clean in the store, all right? And let me say to you, the liminal spray is an agent that you can spray on a sink or something. You're looking at sinks. You look at these two sinks. There were multiple sinks inside the store. To the naked eye, do you see anything? No. What does liminal spray do? It's a reactive agent that reacts to the iron that's in blood. And when you put it on, there's like a black light poster. You spray it on there and bingo, those are those same sinks and same sink areas. Blood everywhere.
Yeah.
All right. These are probably the best luminol pictures I've ever seen.
To be honest.
It's a pretty powerful thing.
Yeah, it is a pretty powerful
So thing. Because she had to clean, look, I think she had to clean herself up. One of the things that we looked into, by the way,
she had 11 hours, you said, to do the whole thing.
She had 11 hours. I went back to the girls that worked with her the day before. And I said, let me ask you something. How was she dressed the day before? They told me what she was dressed like. And I show a picture of what she was dressed like when she was found on the floor of the Lululemon store. Not the same clothing. Now we're going to get to this, but she left the store at some point in time to move Jana's car. Jana's car was directly in front of the store when they went in to get the wallet so she could go home on the bus pass. That's when the murder took place. She couldn't leave Jana's car parked overnight out front. Why? Rachel, the store manager, lived directly across the street in a place many of your listeners might know, Bethesda Row. She lived right there. And everybody knew that Rachel's boyfriend was coming over at like midnight, and they were going to go out and have a late dinner at midnight. If Rachel walks out of her house, looks across the street, sees the car, she's going to go over to the store to find out what's going on. Brittany can't have her come over there. She needs more time to kind of doctor the scene.
But she wasn't caught coming out front.
So like, she was not. When she, at some point in time, Brittany does actually move Jaina's car. And again, I'm just skipping through some of these things.
Oh, okay. So you guys decided to move forward with the case once you found, she said she never had seen the car, then said, oh, I actually drove it that night. You guys found Brittany's blood in her car.
Jaina's blood, not Brittany's blood. We found Jaina's blood in her car, moved about, you know, a third of a mile away.
And so at that point, you're like, your story's not adding up. How did this car get to where it was?
Because on Wednesday, the week after the murder occurred, a couple of police detectives, two fabulous police detectives. One guy's name's Jim Drury. The other was Dimitri Rubin. Fabulous, fabulous detectives. They said to her, do you know what a car looks like? She said, I may have seen it one time, but I don't know what it looks like. The next day, Brittany Nord calls the detectives. I've got to tell you something. I didn't tell you the truth yesterday. I actually do want to know. The men who killed her and raped me told me to move her car, told me that I knew where I lived, and if I didn't come back, they were going to kill me. Because the story then is, why would you, once you get out of there, you're a third of a mile away, there are people walking around. Anybody's ever been down there, you know, 10 or 11 o'clock in downtown Bethesda on this is a Friday, it's a pretty happening place. There's cops, there's civilians.
She changed her clothes, right? She changed her clothes, got in the car.
She changes her clothes. She throws away the money. We never found Jaina's keys. She moves the car away from the location. Again, she had 11 hours to alter the crime scene and did everything she could to alter it. Can I say 19, by the way, in the picture that you see here are the zip ties that were around her hands. There's a box of zip ties in the back during in the shipping area of this store. The zip ties are there. And look, it's so easy to do this. You zip tie your feet. You put the zip ties around your hands. You bite them. And you lay down. That's what she did.
Yeah. And
we had a police officer do it. We were asking him to do it on the floor in the courtroom during the trial. He finished doing it before we could finish asking him if he could do it. He just did it. Laying on the floor in the courtroom.
Yeah, and most criminals don't look for tools at the site, like to assume that Lululemon had zip ties there, to have to look and know where they were in that basket. Like, that's a whole thing.
Right. Yeah, and look, we did try. I've skipped over something there. But, you know, one of the things that we considered doing is there are bite marks experts, people that are odontologists, and we thought about on the zip ties, trying to see if an odontologist could literally match her teeth to the markings on the zip ties. The experts told us that the sample size wasn't significant enough. It wasn't a big enough sample. Couldn't do it. You need more of a whole array. And there are cases.
It's fascinating though that kind of forensics does exist though. It's very interesting.
Well, this is a different case. Different case. That's a dead child. That's a dead 7-year-old child who was murdered by its adoptive mother and wrapped in plastic and duct taped. That's the duct tape that was around that child. That adoptive mother's bite mark, you can see that. I used that in a previous case to prove a double murder of two little girls that were then kept in an ice freezer. So I've used odontology before. I considered it in this case, but the bite mark was not significant enough for us to be able to do that. There's also a lot of other evidence. Oh yeah, we didn't have that. Now, by the way, if any person is a victim of a sexual assault in Montgomery County, we take you to a sane nurse, a sexual assault forensic examiner, who basically has a protocol for examining anybody who claims that they've been the victim of a crime. That was done in Brittany's case, and I think I have a brief piece to play for you.
I honestly thought he'd incinerate me, and he was like, he started to bend inside of me, and then was like...
With his penis, or with what?
And then he was like, I'm not dumb enough. Like, you think I'm not dumb to hurt? You think I would do this? And like, something like, not, I don't know, like, not get caught. And he kept like, my hand was cut open really, like, it was cut really bad, and it was hurting, and... I don't know, I felt like it was something that was making it burn. I don't know, I smelled like cleaner. And he kept, like, spraying, like, something on me, and he sprayed them, like, on my pants and, like, where he'd cut them open and was like, you're so dirty, like, I wouldn't even use my dick to rape you. And he got, like, a hanger and told me he wouldn't stop, and he told me he wouldn't stop until I actually came.
That audio was Brittany Norwood. That was Brittany the same day the murder was discovered. What is pictured here is the very top of the hanger that she claimed that she was raped with. She had no internal injuries.
So
zero.
She didn't fake rape herself with a hanger to make it.
She did not. She told the story, and she put the hanger on the floor next to her. Cut her pants. Like, I'm not going to go back to this.
What about Janae?
Jana Murray.
Oh, Jana. Sorry.
Jana Murray was not sexually assaulted based on the medical examiner's examination at the autopsy. But I covered this up from one of the earlier pictures. There's a lot of evil things that were done here. Lots of evil things. One of the things she did is she slid her pants and then reached in, cut her underwear off of her to make it look like she'd been sexually assaulted. I guess with the idea that if there'd been a sexual assault, it would turn the attention more to a guy than to a woman. I deleted that. So I have that, but I deleted some of that stuff when I was telling the story here today. Pathologist, this Mary Ripple was the medical examiner. Minimum of 331 injuries, 105 are defensive. Now, defensive wounds are probably self-explanatory, but if somebody comes at you with a hammer or is attacking you, you might put your hands up. So you're going to have injuries to a hand or to the underside of your arms. These are very classic defense injuries that you get. Jana had 105 defensive injuries, and a total of 331 injuries at a minimum, because if I hit you in the same place and it creates an injury, but if I incidentally hit you in the same place again, I can't count it as two. It might have been two, might have been three, might have been five, but I know it was at least 331. Sometimes tools actually, this is a wrench that we found there. That's Jana's hand from the autopsy. You can literally see right in the middle portion of her hand here, there's an impression from the wrench. That's a defensive injury among the, besides knives, besides hammers, merch pegs, rope. She was also, and sometimes you can find, there are other, even more disturbing injuries where this young woman was attacked with items where I could specifically say, here's where that weapon was used, and you go, oh, it's so clear to me. I can't show you the pictures. There's the merch peg. Again, that is the primary murder weapon.
How heavy is that?
8 pounds. It's made of iron. It slips into a bracket, and then they hang clothes on it. It really is heavy. And she had 6 skull fractures from that weapon. Here's the good part. This is Jana Murray on her 30th birthday. Gonna do a bungee jump. And she's gonna look right at you at some point in time. You're gonna get, she is a beautiful. beautiful young woman. And you're going to see a tremendously handsome young man who was her fiancé at the time, who she was planning to marry a couple of months after this event took place. Across the hill, and the town lit up, the world got still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Well, the good old days may not return, and the rocks might melt, and the sea may burn. Some say life will beat you down, break your heart, steal your crown. So I started out for God knows where. I guess I'll know when I get there.
I'm like, it's always, a little bit. It's so brutal.
Yeah, yeah. I will tell you what happens,
it's hard for you to.
You get to know some person only, and you only know them in death. But then you look at this picture. But part of it that gets me is where she's there and she looks right at you. There's a part at the end there where she looks right at you. And this is a brilliant, brilliant young woman, 3 master's degree. She was awarded posthumously her 3rd master's degree from Johns Hopkins. She had worked all over the world. She had worked for international corporations. You saw her with her intended husband-to-be a few months away, and they were going to move to Seattle and work in Seattle together.
You're an amazing person for doing the job that you do, because a lot of people couldn't do it. It's brutal. It's just brutal, especially somebody young and, you know, beautiful like that. And what a stupid reason to, you know, to lose a life. But so to wrap this up, because I know, like, we've talked long and it's a very interesting case, but what did the what charges were finally brought against Brittany? What was the outcome of that? Did she ever talk about what exactly she did and why she did it? And then the last question I have is, did Lululemon make any policy changes? Because if the real reason was that she reported her for shoplifting, then it shouldn't be, I guess, a employee's job to do that. I don't know.
I think the bag check policy, I think, is a pretty standard policy in these kinds of industries. I never worked in that kind of a job, but I've been told many times that's very common. I'm not aware of them having made any changes to that. They did redesign the store. They changed it. It's completely different.
PR. Sure.
It's now there's a mosaic that says love over the top of it before. She was convicted of 1st-degree murder. Jury came back. You know, think of where we started from. The jury came back and she was convicted in 18 minutes of 1st-degree murder. She got a sentence of life without the possibility of parole.
So she premeditated this this was.
Well, that was, she was convicted of premeditated first degree murder. And part of it, you know, let me just say this. Part of the fact that Jaina lived through all the attacks, that she changed weapons as many times as she did. The last weapon she used, she had to leave where Jaina was and go to the other side of the store. She picked up a knife that they used to cut bagels with. And she brought the knife back, got back on top of the body and stabbed her in the back of the head. And that's what ultimately killed her. But again, premeditation means you have to have enough time to think about taking someone's life and making a decision to do it. And, you know, look, every time you change all those hours, all those weapons changes, Judge Greenberg, who tried the case, actually said he sat there at his desk. It was Judge Robert Greenberg, now retired, chief judge in my courthouse, now retired, tried this case. He said, I sat there at my desk the other day and I hit the desk 331 times. And he talked about how long it took him to do that. You start putting in the weapons changes. I think this attack took 15 or 20 minutes.
I'm sure.
This went on for a long time.
Did Brittany tell you why?
Brittany has never admitted anything. She's did not apologize. The case went up on appeal. It was appealed. This was a trial. This was not a plea. This was a trial. She was found guilty. She was one of nine children. Brittany, one of the tragedies for her family is some of her brothers and sisters are very, very accomplished. She had doctors and lawyers and her dad came, a man of great dignity, sat through the entire trial. She was a young woman who was a very talented athlete. She was recruited from the West Coast of the United States. She attended school at a university on Long Island on a soccer scholarship. Right. Oh, she was a very, Brittany was a beautiful woman. She was an athletic woman. She on the surface, you would have thought she had a lot of things going for her. When you got beyond the surface, there were lots of troubling things that she'd been involved in. She actually lost her scholarship in college during her senior year when she was caught stealing from her teammates and lost her athletic scholarship. There's other things that occurred in romantic relationships, the things that happened, I don't need to get into, but bottom line is it turned out she was a very troubled young woman and people who were closest to her knew that she'd been troubled for a long time. That it would ever manifest itself the way it did on this occasion, I don't think anybody could have ever predicted that. Absolutely never.
Most people can't, you know, that level of crime. So this was fascinating. Thank you so much for taking the time and answering my questions. I know I peppered in a lot there. I'm one of those internet sleuth people. So I love when to have actual experts to talk to, because it's like, I don't know what I'm talking about. You definitely know what you're talking about. But is there anything else that you would like our listeners and or viewers to know about you? Anything you have coming up? Any place that they can go to learn more information about you?
Well, I've tried a lot of different cases. International cases. I am still working on a case against a woman who's been found incompetent to stand trial here in the county for the potential murder of her two children. I did the first no body murder case in the history of Maryland, Gregory II, in the 1980s. I did the Samuel Scheinbein case where a man committed a murder and then fled to Israel. The golf murders that occurred on Glen Road, where there were five victims that were killed in that. I have a job as state's attorney, but I'm actually a trial lawyer, and I try cases myself, and I continue to try cases, and I tried hundreds of cases over the years being here. It's my great honor to be state's attorney. I know you have many listeners that live in Montgomery County. I think we've done a pretty good job keeping people safe here. The crime rate is actually down tremendously in Montgomery County during the time I've been state's attorney. It's a great honor to be here. I love the fact that you asked me to come. It's a really sad case. It's a sad case. But
Sometimes we have to remind ourselves, and I try to do that in my own head, right? Because true crime is a form of entertainment, is one of those things that is very prevalent in the world today. But we do have to have respect for these victims and their families, because they are people, they're real people that lost their lives. And as fascinating as, you know, details of crimes like this are, I do want to be respectful to the victims and, you know, their family that lost people.
That's why we play the pop, the Tom Petty song at the end, and you get to see her and you go, wow,
Tom Petty gives me all the feels.
That's a real person.
Yeah.
That's a real person who had it all. I mean, she had everything. She really did. Great love in her life. Great education. Beautiful girl. Right. You know, fabulous, fabulous. It's really sad. And if you met her family, that's what happens when you do these cases. Every one of her family members that I've met were equally accomplished people. It's a wonderful, wonderful family.
So you're a father, I'm guessing, correct? Not to make.
I am.
For all your years doing this, what do you do to keep yourself sane? Because I imagine some things come up where you have to, you know, think of your own kids or just.
I work out at lunchtime. When I get done talking to you, I'm going to go work out. I get out of here. I go for a walk or I go play. I get out of here every day. And I'm a beach bum at least one day a week. I escape. I have a beach out. I go away for 24 hours and I try to shut down and hang out at the beach. That's my escape.
You have to, I'm sure, meditate because it, you know. But, okay, thank you so much again. And I will be seeing you on the 11th. You're doing a...
Oh, you're going to...
We haven't announced yet. We have.
Oh, sorry.
We're switching to the 18th.
Okay, cool. I'll be there on the 18th.
I can't wait. Please, I hope some of your listeners will please come as well. Thank you. Barking Mad. 8 o'clock.
It's one of the fan favorites of the Cool Moms of Montgomery County, for sure.
All right, cool. I'll see you there. I can't wait. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Lauren. Bye.
Bye.